Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 92 of Season 3 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today, once again, is Jim O'Kane, the godfather of the Movies by Minute community, and he's done a ton of them, so we're not even going through the whole list right now. No, welcome back, Jim.
Thanks for having me on, Rob. I love this movie. As you know, I did one of these podcasts about Die Hard, and it's always interesting to revisit and reflect on it.
Yes. So minute 92 begins with John greeting the stranger and ends with John offering asylum to this stranger as the stranger, who we know is Hans, looks on evilly. So
yeah.
Yesterday we ended things with Hans finishing to look look at the wires, jumping onto the ground, noticing someone with bare feet, and then noticing a gun pointed in his face. He looks up, and we get to see it's Bruce Willis, which obviously we're not too surprised that it's John McClane. And John then says to him, hi there, how you doing? And I mean, he's very friendly for somebody who should normally be more suspicious at this point. Like, you mentioned it a little bit yesterday at the end of the minute about, we don't know what John really thinks at this point. You know, is he being fooled by this whole whole act that Hans is doing, or is he just playing along and knows that there's something nefarious going on here?
Yeah, I would think that, he's a New York City cop. He should be suspicious of everybody. Everybody's a perp. It's like he shouldn't be trusting in this situation, yes. Especially since there have been so many people trying to kill him.
He's far too friendly.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's like, just put him in cuffs or whatever, and...
Well, he doesn't have cuffs. Doesn't have socks. He doesn't have cuffs.
Yeah, exactly. But, it's like, I'd say, you've got a gun on him, you can tie him up or something like that until you figure it out. Show me some ID.
Yeah.
Don't trust, don't trust his word on it. But again, if he did that, then we wouldn't have the rest of the movie. So
that's correct. That's very true. That it all goes with the script. That's what's in the
yeah, movie. Yeah. It's
right. And okay, Hans does a great job of just swiftly changing his persona and acting very scared. And he goes, "Oh, please, God, no! You're one of them, aren't you? You're one of them. Don't kill me, please. Don't, please." Don't kill me. Don't kill me, please. I mean, I think he overdoes it here.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
he sounds very hysterical the way that he's acting here.
And he's, from what I understand with Alan Rickman, he hated doing this American accent. He said, I can't do an American accent, but they had him do it anyway. It's just, I keep thinking he's drawing on that nervous energy. It's like, oh, I hope this works. I think it's just, he's using that to leverage his performance here. It's I can appreciate trying to get that American accent out. He's doing it a lot better than, say, Dick Van Dyke did in Mary Poppins doing a Cockney accent. But I used to work for a British aircraft company, and when I was working in England, I would always have Brits come up and try out their American accents on me, and it's always interesting how they the parts of the words that they over enunciate to get the American sound. And one of the words that they love trying out is the word Tuesday, which they exaggerate the U in and say Tuesday. And I'm hearing that in Rickman's performance here, where he says, you're one of them. It's like this right. over, it's a very open mouthed you. But it's funny to see that as one of the first sentences out of his mouth is the word "you are one of them."
Yeah.
but beautiful performance. And again, this is almost like it's not for an action movie. It's pretty funny, and this is like just funny how he's doing this overacting job of cowering.
Yeah, completely. I mean, he even gets to the point where you think he's fake crying.
Yeah.
By the way that he's doing it. I mean, Rickman does a great job he does a great job in this movie as a whole, but this particular thing, he's able to fake it really well.
Yeah. Yeah. He's just the moaning and the calling out and stuff. He's just it's nice being over. It gives Bruce Willis something to act against to sound calm and reason. It's like, no, it's okay. You know, I'm not going to hurt you. I'm not going to hurt you.
Right. And you also notice that John moves towards him, and he moves back. You know, he like scampers backwards in order to try and get away.
Yeah.
And like John is, it looks very confused as this is going on. Like, what is going on here? Who is this guy?
Yeah. Yeah. He's really having a problem assessing the situation or trying to, you know, he was expecting to meet up with more, platinum blonde terrorists. And yes. Here's this guy in a suit. And, none of this makes any sense. He doesn't seem like the kind of, you know, he doesn't seem part of the team. He isn't wearing, a black turtleneck and things like that. He isn't wearing heist clothes.
Yes. But he's wearing a suit. So therefore, yeah, that could mean that he's, you know, he is one of the executives. It could be.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so then John says to him, whoa, 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 relax, relax. I'm not going to hurt you. I'm not going to hurt you. You know, in a very reassuring type of tone. That, he's trying to calm him down. And he, you know, Hans calms himself down pretty quickly from that point. You know, because now Hans realizes who he's dealing with here. And then he goes, oh, God. And then John turns to him and says, what the f*** are you doing up here? What were you looking for? And he goes, I managed to get out of there. And I was just trying to get up on the roof and see if I could signal for help, you know? And I mean, again, he says it very convincingly.
Yeah, yeah. He's like, you can't, you know, little old me kind of a thing, that he's not, it's not, he's no threat. And it's just simple for him to be, he's not. He's trying to be as harmless as possible, but in being as harmless as possible, he also is trying to be forceful enough to get McClane to follow him back to where the pistol and the
flashlight.
The flashlight is. So, you know, and which we see in the foreground.
Yes.
So he's kind of trapped himself here because he has to seem like, he's wishy-washy and he's not, you know, go with the flow kind of a thing. And he's scared, but now he has to be assertive enough to get McClane to come back so he can, you know, take charge and find out he can't kill McClane because he's got to get those detonators. So he's also the stakes for him are he can't kill McClane because he's got to know where the detonators went. And, but he still has to take charge of the situation because McClane's the one with the gun.
Right. Okay. You're correct. But if he's looking directly at McClane, he'll see that he is carrying Heinrich's bag, which he can assume has the detonators in it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he could guess that is, but he doesn't know it for certain. That's all I'm just thinking.
Correct. He could have stashed it somewhere.
Yeah. It's a beautiful setup for the unknown of how much, how much information needs to be gleaned by either side. So they're both at a disadvantage, which is beautiful. I mean, this is where you want to go in a script because you can understand the stakes for both of them. All the cards, at least to the audience, all the cards are on the table.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like if you watch episodes of Columbo, you already know who the murderer is, what's happened. And then you have to see how he figures it out. So right. This is kind of the Columbo method of storytelling.
Yeah, I mean, I like the fact also that you know, Hans starts pulling himself up as he's cowering back in order to get to the other side, you know, that type of thing. Yeah. And then he like points in the direction of where his gun is and goes, it's just through here. Why don't you come and help? Help with what?
Yeah.
Like, what is
well,
he?
I mean, it's. Like,
is he saying, come and help me to signal?
Yeah, it's.
It just sounds strange saying it that way.
Yeah, he doesn't have a good enough story to get him to follow along. It's like,
right.
You've got to, you know, if he had said something like, my coworker Debbie is, down the hall here, and if you could take a look at her and see if there's any way we could help her, You know, that's, I think that would have been a better plan for him to get him along. Because he's looking for people that he can rescue and, you know, things that he could save.
Right.
But
right. Yeah. But he's not thinking that much on his feet.
Yeah.
You know, but like he tries to get John to go in that direction. And then they give us a great shot because you see Hans now in the background, but in the foreground, you see that small little corridor and you're able to see that the gun is just sitting there.
Yeah.
You know, and you can see the edge of the flashlight too, if he wants to, you know, use that to hit John over the head with.
Yeah. It's just waiting. You know, it's like the scissors in Dial M for Murder. It's like, there's the thing. If you get that, you can, you know, kill the guy. Right. So it's set up really well. Yeah, and it's a scene within a movie that, you know, it's a movie within itself, that here's the storyline, and is it going to get resolved or not resolved? And it does get resolved by forget the roof.
Right, exactly, because at this point John goes, whoa, forget the roof, but Hans continues and says, come on, and then John has to reiterate and says, I said forget the roof, they got people all over it, come on, you want to stay alive, you stay with me.
Yeah, I think Schwarzenegger could sue him for that paraphrase. Come with me if you want to live. You know.
Yeah.
So, but yeah.
Well, that's actually Michael Biehn first, but
yeah. So. Okay. Yeah, that's true.
Especially in '88, because in '88, yeah, you still hadn't had Schwarzenegger say the line. You had to wait another 3 years for that.
True. It was. He absconded with it, and then I guess it's just passed around to all the action stars of the '80s.
Yeah. And again, they leave it very ambiguous as to what John really believes here.
Yeah.
You know, is he saying don't go to the roof because there's someone up there really, or is he saying don't go up to the roof because I don't trust you?
Yeah. I mean, how far?
That I want to first see who you are. I want to check you out a little bit more.
Yeah, could have asked for an ID, but he doesn't even know his name yet. So
correct. Well, we'll get there later in the week.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. But he's, you know, he's just trying to sort things out still in his mind.
But John remains calm the entire time here.
Yeah, and he also knows that there's no salvation in the roof. He knows that it's not getting to the roof that's going to do things. He's got to figure out how to disable more terrorists, as many as he can get rid of, and just pick them off.
Right.
So escape is not going to be through the roof. It's going to be by getting, you know, carving his way through all the terrorists.
Right. Well, John's goal is not to escape.
Yeah.
You know, his goal is to solve the, you know, to stop everything.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, because he wants to get his wife. You know, that's his goal. If he wanted to escape, I'm assuming he would have found a way to have escaped right at the beginning.
Right.
You know, just start, slowly sneak your way downstairs and just go out, go out where no one's looking.
Yeah, he's only 35 floors from salvation. So,
correct.
And Gruber never makes a good enough argument to be the leader. So it's definitely Gruber's fault that he hasn't out-talked or out-thought McClane. McClane's been playing four-dimensional chess through this whole incident or, you know, the event, and Gruber is not keeping up with him.
Right. I mean, I've mentioned this numerous times. The difference between them is that John is playing everything street smart, and Hans is playing everything, I guess you could say, business smart. You know, yeah. He has his whole plan set out. He knows how he's going to do everything, and he's not as good thinking on his feet.
Yeah, it's the coyote and the roadrunner. He's got all these massive, you know, you can almost picture the blueprints of how this is what's going to happen next. And he thought ahead. I mean, he understands how the police work, but he doesn't understand how a New York City policeman, a detective works.
Right.
He's not on. They're both on different levels of play.
Right. And I mean, this movie also sort of makes it seem as if a New York cop and a potential LA cop would be acting differently in this situation also.
Yeah. And it's, it looks like Gruber doesn't deal well with chaos, and McClane is nothing but chaotic. His role in all of this is to disrupt. He disrupts everybody's plans. Everybody, he's doing the opposite of what they think that he's going to do. They think that he'd run for cover. They think he'd try to get out of the building and, you know, close off ways of him for getting out of the building. But that, you know, like Darth Vader said, escape is not his plan.
So, right. No, but I think part of it is that Hans isn't able to figure out why John is still staying there. You know, he knows from the whole thing with Ellis that he knows somebody there. You know, Ellis wouldn't know that his name is John McClane from the New York City Police Department if he wasn't introduced to him at some point. You know, the fact that Ellis wasn't able to be smart enough to, you know, to just give up Holly, that would have been, you know, you think that that's what he would have done.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Fortunately for Holly, she didn't take his name or keep his name.
Yeah. Because Hans is sitting in the office. You know, he would have walked in and go, Holly McClane. Where have I heard of that name McClane before?
he couldn't even find him in the building directory. So that's
that's right. You can find your zipper, but you can't find you can't find Holly McClane.
Yeah. Ah, wow. But a great, I mean, this is a great, I don't usually like a tell versus show. But this is a lot of tell, you know, in explaining how each one of them is presenting fault. Well, McClane isn't lying, but,
he's not lying, but he's still keeping his cards very close to his chest.
Exactly. Yeah. And that will probably change in the near future, but
maybe later this week we'll see that change a little bit. Who knows?
It's intriguing. And I do know. I mean, we were talking yesterday about ties. For a guy who's very nervous, Hans as the Nakatomi employee is very he has very well knotted tie. he's definitely in much better shape than Paul Gleason's character.
Yeah, that's true. But maybe it's because he was at a party.
Yeah,
I mean his cufflinks are also perfect. You have the right amount of shirt, you know, sticking out of the jacket.
Yeah, very dashing '80s guy. I mean, he is not prone to the American style, which as we saw yesterday with the FBI guys and. With the LAPD detectives, they wear the blue shirts with the mid '80s white collar with the on a blue shirt.
Right.
So that which I think was in fashion for maybe 3 months somewhere towards
apparently,
the end of the '80s.
Apparently in 1987 when they were filming
Christmas apparently. That's right. So everybody got one of those for their birthday or Father's Day or something.
I mean, I love the way that he tries to, you know, that Hans tries to goad John into a trap. You know, he's in this situation. You and I have discussed the fact that he's not really good at planning things on the spot, but he does a nice job of making this facade or creating this facade of this type of character, you know, this employee who somehow escaped and is really, really scared. And despite this, he's still trying to goad John into following him so that he can shoot him. You know, able to take on this new persona quite well.
And how far is this persona from Ellis? I mean, I thought he was trying to copy Ellis. I mean, this is how if Ellis was push comes to shove. I mean, he was trying to be cool with everybody, but if, you know, he had a gun pointed at his face, I think he would have reacted like this. And Hans is channeling the late great Ellis in this minute.
Oh, that's actually very interesting. I've never thought about that. That he is channeling that. Yeah, okay. Because he is acting hysterical. So maybe Hans just thinks that that's how all American businessmen act, even though he might not have realized that Ellis was high at the time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, If you want to impersonate a coked out businessman at a Christmas party, this is what it looks like.
There you go.
And again, this is Alan Rickman at the top of his game. This is one of his one of his top showcases, and being able to play this role, being able to be silly after being such a, you know, this reserved guy that can you know, execute people at the drop of a hat, and here, you know, he also gets to play frantic cowardly California businessman. Amazing the range on this guy.
Yeah, for
and,
sure.
And you get the impression that they were both having a lot of fun filming it.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Everyone in this movie looks like they're having fun filming it. I mean, come on, Argyle must be having, you know, the Devorah White must have had a really fun time with all of his scenes. And you'd think that also the Johnsons had fun, you know, playing these type of characters.
And each trying to out deadpan the other.
Yeah, exactly.
I've never seen the blooper reel for this. I'm sure it exists somewhere, but I can imagine.
That's
probably must have been wild.
That's probably true. Do you have anything else you want to say before we get into the script?
No, I'm pretty far along on this. There's not much to this minute, but it does reveal a lot.
So the script actually is, there's more discrepancies in the script for this minute than there was for yesterday. So first of all, McClane starts not by saying, "Hi there, how are you?" He says, "Lost." And then it says, "A moment." And then Hans turns, looks up. The transformation in his expression and bearing are mind-boggling. Hands shaking, eyes filled with fear. He swallows, looks up at McClane, and in a perfect American accent says, and then they start saying all of it, and he goes, "You're one of them. I know it." You know, they cut out the "I know it" part of it. And then later on, when he tries to get him to go up to the roof, so McClane goes, "Forget it. They got a guy up there. You want to stay alive? Keep moving. Hey, you hear me?" And then it says Hans realizes this tactic won't work, so he follows McClane. Then Hans says, you're an American. And then McClane's friendly, easing the man's fear, says, "Only if New Jersey counts." It says it works. The poor frightened civilian shows a hint of a smile.
Wow.
So there are some changes there, but it's not necessary. It works really well in the final cut. So I don't think it really needed that.
No. And again, it rolls through to show the strength of, you know, what it could probably be improv that they're doing here. It's like, you got to get from this point in the scene to this point in the scene, and we'll let you two act it out.
Yeah.
It's fascinating seeing this all being spooled out on the screen. And I just, you know, it really shows the power of what happens if you get two actors who know what they're doing in front of a camera.
No question about that. So every Tuesday we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track, Holiday Edition, where my guest will give a little story, anecdote, adventure, misadventure, something that happened to them related to a holiday or something like that.
I am going to tell you a story that was related to me by Van Dyke Parks. Van Dyke Parks was in I run a website called tvdads.com, and it talks about single dads on television. And one of the earliest single dad shows on television, American television, was a show called Benino, and it starred Ezio Pinza, who was in he was in the role in South Pacific. He played the lead role in South Pacific. And he was in the show, he was the father of seven boys. And the actors in the show, one of them was a kid, was Van Dyke Parks. He's a composer. He worked with Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys and did a lot of things on Pet Sounds and stuff. Anyway, Van Dyke was kind enough to talk to me about this early television show, which was first made in 1952. At the time, Van Dyke Parks was at a boarding school in Princeton, New Jersey. It was called the American Boy Choir, and it's kind of like the Vienna Boys Choir. He was a singer, and he sang with a bunch of other little boys, and they went all around the country and all around the world singing. And this was the boarding school was on the grounds of Princeton University, and this is in the early 50s. Mm-hmm. At the same time he was there, was during the when on the faculty was Dr. Albert Einstein.
Oh, wow.
And the American Boy Choir would go caroling in Princeton and around the university. And so they would go house to house singing Christmas carols. And they got to the home of Dr. and Mrs. Einstein. And they stood outside and they started singing Silent Night in German, in the original German. And Dr. Einstein and his wife were standing out front. And as they started, as they began singing, Professor Einstein disappeared off the front step. And they just kept singing. And all of a sudden, as they were getting toward the middle of the verse, they were accompanied by a violin. And it was Albert Einstein on his front steps of his house in the snow, playing Stille Nacht with the American Boy Choir. And they were, you know, they were accompanied by Albert Einstein on a violin playing the song. And
oh,
just
wow.
that image of Einstein in the snow with a bunch of boys around singing, just amazing. And it's one of those things, after you hear that story, it's like, wow, where do you go from there?
seriously.
I find
it interesting I mean, Einstein was Jewish, so
yeah, but he knew Silent Night. It's pretty easy to play, and I know he played the violin like every day. Apparently, that was his relaxation, and but you know, the idea of him just coming out to play along, it's just amazing. He told me that later on the show was filmed in what's now the Renaissance Theater on 46th Street, and it's just off of Times Square. And so Van Dyke used to take a train from Princeton to Manhattan every once a week when they do, well, twice a week. They do one rehearsal, and he'd go back and they do the show, which was shown live for NBC. And one time he saw, after this, he saw Albert Einstein on the train going to New York with him.
Oh, wow.
And so he went up to him and he said, Dr. Einstein, would you mind signing an autograph? And he said, I'm sorry, I don't do that. And one of the other commuters said, come on, professor, the kid just wants your autograph. So he said, okay. And he signed a program for him. And Van Dyke says he now has that in a frame in his house. And it's in a frame, as far as I understand, it's the famous picture of Einstein sticking his tongue out, and underneath it, you know, it's like just Albert Einstein. But I had never heard of all things an Albert Einstein Christmas story.
Seriously.
But yeah, it's just a very, very odd little story, but one that's great to tell. I don't tell it as well as Van Dyke Park does, but yeah, it's just
you do a good enough job of it, Jim.
Wow. Well, I hope it was entertaining. Yes.
It was. It was. Thank you. Thank you very much. So you want to once again tell people how they can get in touch with you?
Sure. I am one of the Movies by Minutes people. We do a lot of different shows currently. Well, coming up in February, I don't want you to wait for the future, but we've got two shows, a show I'm working on with my good friend Hal Bryan and my new good friend, director Joe Johnston. We're doing the October Sky Minute, which discusses Joe Johnston's film from 1999. I'm sorry. That is right.
1999.
1999. Joe Johnston directed film October Sky, about the early days of rocketry and growing up in West Virginia. So we're starting that in February of 2023. If you'd like to listen to one of my existing shows featuring Joe Johnston, please check out the Rocketeer Minute, where we go over Joe Johnston's 1991 Disney movie, which features not only Joe Johnston, but the Rocketeer himself, William Campbell. Billy Campbell is on our show. He joined us for about 40 episodes. So that's at rocketeerminute.com.
Oh, wow. All right, great. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook, or you can go directly to my website, moviearoundminute.com. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.